If you enjoy our podcasts, why not subscribe to The Spectator too for more from your favourite podcast hosts and guests? You can get 3 months of The Spectator for just £3 right now if you go to spectator.co.uk/trial.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud. Each week we choose some of our favourite pieces from the magazine and ask their writers to read them aloud. I'm Patrick Gibbons, and on this week's podcast, with Trump's announcement of the junior senator from Ohio, J.D. Vance, as his nominee for VP, our economics editor, Kate Andrews, argues that Vance is more MAGA than Trump. Professor of astrophysics Adam Frank explains scientists' desire to understand so-called super-Earths and sub-Neptunes, asking what life might look like on another planet. Fresh from his attempt to cross the Atlantic on a hydrogen balloon, Sir David Hempelman Adams recounts the trip in his Explorer's Notebook. The Spectator's Svetlana Mornets reports on Putin's second front as Ukrainian forces battle to save the Kharkiv region. And finally, have the Olympics ever been politics-free? Looking ahead to Paris 2024, Michael Belov, a King's Counsel of Blackstone Chambers and a five-time Olympic arbitrator, takes us through a history of the Games through a mixture of books published this year. Up first, Kate Andrews.
It shows a remarkable level of confidence from Donald Trump that he's chosen for his running mate the man who once called him America's Hitler. J.D. Vance, the 39-year-old junior senator from Ohio, made the private comment in 2016 as he rose to fame off the back of his autobiography, Hillbilly Elegy. The book recounts what it was like to grow up in a deprived Rust Belt town where his family and neighbors had no college degree and poverty's a family tradition. Vance escaped by joining the U.S. Marine Corps, which included a tour in Iraq. Once home, his degrees from Ohio State University and Yale took him to California, where he worked for the entrepreneur and Republican backer Peter Thiel, who was reported to have arranged the first meeting between Vance and Trump. Vance wasn't just establishing himself as an author. He was starting to make a name for himself politically, too, as a never-Trumper who thought the president was reprehensible, an idiot, and cultural heroin. 6 years later, Vance successfully ran for the Senate in Ohio as a MAGA-affiliated candidate. He became one of the former president's biggest supporters, defending his actions on the 6th of January and repeating Trump's claim that the 2020 election was stolen. What changed? In an interview with the New York Times earlier this year, Vance describes the complete overreaction after Trump's 2016 win to the mere suggestion that the president might sometimes have a point. By the 2020 election, Vance's vote for Trump was a protest vote against being policed in what we think and what we say. Fortunately for Vance, Trump can be forgiving towards those who repent and do penance. Humiliation is part of the punishment. J.D. is kissing my ass, Trump told a rally of Ohioans in September 2022. Yeah, he says some bad things about me, but that was before he knew me, and then he fell in love. Despite their past differences, Trump and Vance are now thought to be politically aligned. Joe Biden described Vance as a clone of Trump. Yet there are some notable differences between them. Vance is a devout Catholic convert, whereas Trump could not name his favorite verse in what he says is his favorite book, the Bible. Their biggest differences, however, come down to extremes. On policy, Vance tends to out-MAGA Trump. While Trump is vague on the extent of his support for Ukraine, Vance has called for an end to the war, which would cede territory to Russia. I don't really care what happens to Ukraine, he said in 2022. Vance wants the resources that are flowing to Europe to be diverted to America's borders, as well as towards Taiwan, a move he thinks that could stop China invading. Vance goes further on the economy, too. For all of Trump's protectionist rhetoric, the crux of his economic agenda in office was broadly laissez-faire, a combination of lower taxes and market liberalization with the odd Trumpian threat of a trade war thrown in to keep China and Europe on their toes. If Vance gets his way, tariffs are the future. He seems relaxed about price rises, which he thinks are exaggerated, and tax hikes, so long as immigration is curbed and wages rise. His answer for filling in budget deficits is not to force America's unemployed back to work, but to entice them. The Republican Party hopes Vance's economic outlook will appeal to trade union voters. This week, the head of the Teamsters Union, which represents 1.3 million workers, spoke at the Republican National Convention for the first time in history. Vance may be a poster boy for the American dream, journeying from absolute poverty to Silicon Valley to Congress. Trump has selected him as VP to highlight a different journey, Trump naysayer to MAGA enthusiast. The Trump fans' ticket is Trump's way of showing off his unprecedented level of power over the Republican Party. In 2016, he chose Mike Pence as his VP to reassure its traditional wing. That's a concession he doesn't need to make anymore. With Vance's nomination, the MAGA takeover of the Republican Party is complete.
That was Kate Andrews. Now, Adam Frank.
Over the last three decades, astronomers have discovered planets orbiting sun-like stars throughout the universe. This discovery ended 2,500 years of debate about whether worlds existed beyond our solar system. But it came with a kind of shock. The most common kind of planet in the universe is the type of world that doesn't exist in our small corner of the cosmos. What astronomers call super-Earths and sub-Neptunes. Planets with much greater masses than ours and which could, in theory, sustain life. Astronomers concluded a little over a decade ago that every star in the sky hosts a family of worlds. Importantly for the search for life, one in five of those stars will have a planet in the Goldilocks zone, sometimes referred to as the habitable zone. That's the band of orbits that are just right for water to pool up on a planet's surface into puddles, lakes, and oceans. It's a good bet that life needs liquid water to form. So the discovery of Goldilocks worlds, of which there are billions, pushed the search for extraterrestrial life to the front of science's to-do list. Planet hunting across interstellar distances is spectacularly difficult. At first, all scientists could learn from their telescopes was the size and mass of newly discovered worlds. That was enough to see that the galaxy's average planet, the kind that appears most often in most solar systems, looks nothing like the worlds orbiting our sun. Our solar system has two kinds of worlds. In the inner solar system, there are the terrestrial worlds, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars. These are basically spherical layer cakes of metal and rock. Their cores mostly iron and nickel, their outer layers mostly made of rock stuff, silicon, oxygen, and magnesium. Further out in the solar system lie giant worlds. These are the giant planets Jupiter and Saturn, which weigh more than 100 times Earth's mass and are mostly made of hydrogen and helium. Then come the ice giants, Uranus and Neptune, which are surrounded by layers of frozen slush made of ammonia, methane, and other compounds. Terrestrial worlds and giants. That's it for our solar system. There's no other planets orbiting our sun with a mass between a terrestrial Earth and an ice giant Uranus, which is 14 times the mass of the Earth. In the wider universe, however, the most common kind of planet lies right in that empty space between these two forms. These worlds are known as super-Earths and sub-Neptunes. With billions of these planets strewn across the galaxy, their ability to host life becomes an urgent question. Are super-Earths just scaled-up versions of our world requiring scaled-up versions of Earth life? Or are they something else entirely? Answering this has put scientists under pressure. That's not a figure of speech. Understanding super-Earths and sub-Neptune means understanding pressure. A planet's gravitational pull increases with depth. At the Earth's core, the gravity squeeze reaches a million times that at the surface. Those high pressures deep in our planet's interior aren't inconsequential. They set the conditions for life at the surface, including the presence of tectonic plates, which shaped evolution, and magnetic fields, which shield us from dangerous solar radiation. What happens below shapes what happens above. All the extra mass inside super-Earths and sub-Neptunes means their interior squeeze is driven to extremes that scientists don't understand. How does rock behave deep in a super-Earth when it's crushed 100 times harder than inside Earth? Will it still flow slowly like road tar in a hot day, creating something similar to Earth's drifting continents? Or are tectonic plates a scientific impossibility on super-Earths? How does ice behave when it's subject to the insane pressures deep in a sub-Neptune? Directly exploring the extreme pressures in super-Earths and sub-Neptunes pushes scientists to their own extremes. Traditional laboratory methods can't reach pressures 100 times higher than Earth's core. So we can't replicate what's happening on the surface of these distant worlds. Facing that limit, planetary scientists have joined forces with plasma physicists who run giant lasers at places like the Laboratory for Laser Energetics in upstate New York, where I'm a scientist. These city block-sized lasers were initially developed to study nuclear fusion. The work has already borne fruit. High-intensity laser light was recently used to compress iron to super-Earth pressures and gives us a clue about the temperature at which solid iron at the center of a super-Earth will melt into liquid. Swirling currents of liquid iron at the Earth's center are what give our planet its magnetic field, a field that deflects harmful particles from the sun. The tests indicate that super-Earths might host their own life-protecting magnetic fields. The extreme interiors of super-Earths represent only half the problem for understanding these mystery worlds. If we want to know about the surface conditions where life can form, astronomers also need to understand their atmospheres. The Earth probably didn't start with a thin but life-giving veil of gases we enjoy today. When it was first formed, it had a molten rock surface, a magma ocean, which was probably surrounded by a thick atmosphere of hydrogen and helium gas. But those elements are so light that Earth's gravity couldn't hold on to them for long, and they quickly bounced off into space. Only later, as the magma ocean cooled, gases like carbon dioxide and nitrogen were pushed out of the newly solidified rock to form a secondary atmosphere. The oxygen we breathe came billions of years later. Super-Earths and sub-Neptunes probably started in the same way, but because they're so much larger, it's possible they held on to their original atmospheres. When it comes to life on these worlds, everything depends on whether they have or haven't. Unlike our planet, most super-Earths should have enough gravity to hold on to their big, puffy, primordial hydrogen atmospheres. And here's the important point. Hydrogen is a powerful greenhouse gas, far better at trapping solar energy than, say, carbon dioxide. The hydrogen atmosphere is so good at holding in heat that the surface of these worlds can end up hotter than a pizza oven. Not a great place for life. But astronomers have observed that many planets with super-Earth masses appear not to have big, puffy, extended atmosphere. So where did the hydrogen go? The culprit appears to be the parent star, whose radiation can strip a super-Earth of its hydrogen veil. This would suggest that super-Earths are habitable. If they can push out secondary atmospheres, as the Earth did billions of years ago, then perhaps their surfaces might end up hospitable for life. Sub-Neptunes provide more atmospheric mysteries. The Cambridge astronomer Niku Madhusudan and his colleagues recently made the radical proposal that some sub-Neptunes may be Hycean worlds. Madhusudan gave this name to planets with hydrogen atmospheres and vast liquid oceans on the surface. Hydrogen ocean equals Hycean. Madhusudan realized that the enhanced greenhouse warming from the hydrogen atmospheres can change everything that we'd expect about habitable zones. By trapping so much solar energy in a hydrogen layer, planets far away from the host star can still exist in a warm liquid state. If so, then Hycean worlds could constitute an entirely new class of habitable planet. Using the James Webb Space Telescope, Madhusudan's team recently found evidence that K2-18b, a sub-Neptune orbiting a red dwarf star in the constellation of Leo, showed strong evidence for being a Hycean world. It's a huge planet with 8 times more mass than Earth, and its ocean would be equally impressive. Earth's seas go no deeper than 7 miles. But if K2-18b is Hycean, then its oceans could cover the entire planet, reaching depths of 500 miles. If 500-mile-deep Hycean world oceans exist, then the question becomes, can life exist in dark seas where the pressures would be millions of times higher than on Earth's ocean floor? No one knows. Some questions about super-Earths and sub-Neptune worlds may require the next generation of giant ground-based telescopes which are being built now. These monsters will have mirrors almost as large as football fields. The effort will eventually pay off. Super-Earths and sub-Neptunes are the most alien of alien worlds because we didn't even know they existed until recently. After contemplating our solar system for thousands of years, we're suddenly confronted with how limited our vision has been. But these worlds will soon become familiar, and if we aren't alone, at some point, so too will be their inhabitants.
That was Adam Frank. Now, David Hempelman Adams.
I was hoping to fly the first hydrogen balloon across the Atlantic and had been waiting for a year to get the right call from our weathermen. I postponed the trip last year when there was not a single track that would get us from the USA to Europe. Was it climate change? I have flown solo across the Atlantic in a balloon twice before. Well, then when we say solo, the reality is a huge team of backstage staff to get you into the air safely and support the flight and the landing. This would be no different, except I would be accompanied by two fellow Bloom pilots, Bert Padelt and Frederick Paulson. In the past, weather patterns were stable for days. They now change more quickly, as anyone trying to barbecue this summer will certainly know. Most people's understanding of ballooning mostly comes from the beautiful, peaceful balloons seen floating across the English landscape. These balloons use hot air, heated by propane burners, and so, because of the weight of the propane tanks, have a limited maximum duration of a couple of hours. We needed a few days for our trip, so a gas balloon would be better. It is a very simple concept, a gas cell filled with either helium or hydrogen. Helium has become incredibly expensive. This is partly due to its use in MRI scanners and the Chinese discovering party balloons. Hydrogen is cheap by comparison, a byproduct of several industrial processes, but it is mostly commonly associated with the Hindenburg disaster. Insurance companies have a list of caveats, as long as the NHS waiting list. A balloon is the oldest form of flying machine. Sand is used as ballast. To go up a couple of feet, a scoop of sand is dropped over the side. A larger poo allows the balloon to go up hundreds of feet. To come down, a rope is pulled, which opens a valve in the top, releasing the gas. Balloons nowadays are classed as registered aircraft, which means they come with all the paraphernalia of a modern flight. We have radios to talk to air traffic control, transponders so that we show up on the monitoring equipment of other aircraft, tracking devices, and emergency beacons. The food is also airline standard. We dine on pork scratchings, swilled down with English breakfast tea, as well as the odd biscuit. American biscuits are quadruple the size of British ones and are useful for ballast. Our Torabeg Atlantic Explorer team consisted of Americans, English and one Swede. Someone once said England and America are two nations separated by a common language. That should extend to food and every other aspect of life. America being as great a culture shock as any of the remote places I have travelled to. Watching an English and an American team of balloonists discussing weather and logistics was just like going back to school to learn a new language. We all know the standard differences, boot and trunk, chips and french fries. But when they started pumping hydrogen into the balloon and I said, "No smoking, any fags," that caused a real kerfuffle. We took off from Presque Isle, a small town in northern Maine, which is known for snow and potatoes. The first ever Atlantic balloon crossing took off from here in 1978, successfully landed in France. Our predicted track showed us landing at the same destination. Using powerful computers, our teams of meteorologists had our high splits worked out, showing the altitude we would have to fly in each part of the crossing to get us into a field in France. The weathermen in 1978 just put a finger in the air and said, "Bon voyage." Our team worked through the night to get the balloon inflated. It looked magnificent on the launch site, floodlit in the night sky. The three of us would be sleeping on the floor of the basket in a space no bigger than a kitchen table. We slowly climbed into the night sky to the strains of the Star Spangled Banner and immediately found the actual weather was not as forecast. "How can they get it so wrong so quickly?" I thought. But as the weather gurus often tell me, they only forecast, they don't actually make the weather. Speed, direction, cloud cover and temperature were all off. We were soon making a beeline from Greenland, with target altitudes that would have left us too low on ballast to make it across. We discussed the latest patterns with the control room and tried for 8 hours to find the right tracks, but they were simply not there. We had some quick decisions to make. Ditching the cold North Atlantic if we ran out of sand, which, on our current usage, we surely would, and I hate swimming. Or quickly do an emergency landing on the ever-dwindling land below us. We landed in a French-speaking part of the world, just on the wrong side of the Atlantic. We ended up 88 miles away in New Brunswick, Canada, which was disappointing. What's more, Canadian mosquitoes love sweet English blood. Bug spray was not on the kit list, which was a terrible omission. We gave the balloon basket a quick brush, put it in storage, and left Maine for England by plane with our tails between our legs. It has now been a week since we landed, but what a week. The election, European football, Wimbledon, and Formula One. As all those teams know, you win some and you lose some. It's only a failure if you don't at least try.
That was David Hempelman Adams. Next, Svetlana Mornatz.
Moonlight shines on the wings of reconnaissance drone as it glides over the field. Within minutes, the Leleka, Ukrainian for stork, crosses the border into Russia's Belgorod region. The soldiers monitoring it wait in the car, hidden in the undergrowth. Soon the image on their laptop freezes. The Russians are jamming the signal. They maneuver the Leleka back and forth, eventually finding a gap in the enemy's electronic defenses. The drone is back in contact, sending footage of Russian roads and towns. The hunt for enemy troops begins. Some 30,000 Russian soldiers are amassed north of Ovchansk, a Ukrainian border town that was attacked 2 months ago. It is now split in two, with Russian forces occupying one half but struggling to advance beyond the aggregate plant in the town center. I'm with Ukraine's 71st Jaeger Brigade's drone unit, which is tasked with locating Russian weapons and vehicles before the army breaches the border. The Kharkiv region is Vladimir Putin's second front. He has had mixed results so far, but a new push is still expected this summer. Even more Russian soldiers arrived in recent weeks, says Noha, the commander of the drone unit. They are regrouping for something larger. An order seems to have come to push us away from the border, so we wouldn't hit there. Putin has said he is carving out a buffer zone to protect Russia from Ukrainian attacks, but the real aim has been to extend the front line to stretch Ukraine's resources. The threat of losing Kharkiv, Ukraine's second largest city, meant elite units were redeployed to the north, away from Donbas in the east. Now Russian troops are capturing village after village in the Donetsk region. Putin's plan has worked then, but at a cost. British military intelligence estimates that Russia has lost more than 70,000 troops, dead and wounded, in the past 2 months. Opening the front at Kharkiv has stretched Russian resources too. To fend off the new offensive, the US gave Ukraine permission to fire American weapons across the border into Russia. Ukraine-made drones are bombing just over the border, while Western missiles are reserved for targets further into Russian border regions. After the first American HIMARS launcher destroyed an S-300 missile system in Belgorod more than a month ago, rockets stopped flying towards Kharkiv. The US has said it is ready to authorize attacks deeper into Russia if Putin tries to expand the front again. Russia's response is to use its citizens as human shields. Russians station their artillery under houses, along roads where Russian people drive, where public transport runs, says Noha. If Western weapons cause civilian casualties, Kyiv would be in trouble, hence the importance of drone imagery, to check whether a potential target is worth attacking and what weapons would be suitable. Even if the video freezes due to anti-drone measures, the Leleka flash drive records everything, Noha says. If the drone returns, we get the highest quality picture and decrypt it before morning. There are 500 Leleka crews spread across the front, conducting reconnaissance missions. After we destroyed some of their automatic artillery, Russians began to hide more and more away with the equipment. They do not come so close anymore, says Noha. Battle-hardened Russian soldiers stay behind, while the fresher recruits, who are considered less valuable, are sent to attack. Some try to break through. Well, they don't go far. Vovchansk isn't the only new front that has opened in the north. Russia also is trying to capture Lipsy, a village about 23 miles west of here and 19 miles north of Kharkiv. Soldiers call it the gate to Kharkiv. If it falls, the Russians will be close enough to flatten the city with artillery fire, as they did Bakhmut and Avdiivka. There are just 2 miles of territory between Russian troops and Lipsy. The Ukrainians defending the village are bombarded by dozens of powerful glide bombs dropped from Su-34 aircraft. This can destroy any fortifications. Last night, Russians dropped at least 15 glide bombs on us, says Roman, commander of the mortar unit of the Spartan 3rd Operational Brigade, which is stationed half a mile from Leipzig. We are sitting on soldiers' mattresses in the cellar of an abandoned house. As we talk, the explosions are incessant. The glide bombs, Roman says, will destroy Leipzig. There will be no houses, nowhere to hide, no place to turn into a position. It will be like in Roboteno, a village in the Zaporizhia region, where our soldiers come in and go out, and the Russians come in and go out. There is no way to gain a foothold there. The village was simply leveled. Ukraine doesn't have the means to intercept the glide bombs, but the planes carrying them can be shot down with the F-16s that are due to arrive shortly. These jets will bring new opportunities but also questions about how they can be kept safe. Not long ago, a Russian drone spotted six Ukrainian Sukhoi Su-27 fighter stations at a base, and in no time an Iskander missile barrel had destroyed two of them and damaged the rest. From the moment the F-16s arrive, Russia will be bent on their destruction. Leipzig is built on high ground, which makes it hard to capture. Russian troops attack in small groups of up to five soldiers. They capture a position, dig in, and wait for a second group to bring provisions and ammunition. One group might have a person without any weapons at all, just with a shovel, says Roman. Their task is purely to dig, dig, dig. When enough soldiers gather in one place, they advance further in larger numbers. When I ask about the likelihood of Leipzig falling to the Russians, Roman seems optimistic that it can hold. Our soldiers, I think, have already secured themselves well. I don't think there are any chances for them. Both sides have been devastated by artillery, mortars and drones. Ukraine's ammunition is scarce, but the situation is improving. One commander told me that, at one point, they only had 10 shells per day for a dozen howitzers. Now, thanks to US aid and the Czech initiative to provide 500,000 shells this year, stocks are replenished nightly. Russia's artillery advantage over Ukraine has shrunk from 10 to 1 to just 3 to 1 in the last few months. The only way to capture territory is for the infantry to advance, however, so the scene is set for a brutal trench battle. A couple of miles away from the front, I meet Alyeshka, a soldier in the 36th Marine Brigade. In any other campaign, he would already have been discharged for his war injuries. My leg doesn't bend here, you see, and it doesn't bend here. The screw is set here. I can walk, I can't run, he says. One of his roles is to train new recruits. Real war, he tells them, is far from the romanticized version they have seen in films. The first close battle is decisive, and fear is dangerous. They see a Russian coming, they start throwing up or just freeze. Sometimes there is no time to prepare. We basically dig everything with our own strength, chop the ground to get a little bit of foothold. Alyeshka waves a hand to indicate the thick forest around us. In such a setting, building fortifications is a nightmare. Besides needing more weapons, Ukraine has to contend with exhaustion, dwindling motivation and a large shortfall of new recruits. Initially, a conscription law that was voted for in April was intended to grant a 2-year leave for those who had fought for 36 months. But this amendment was removed from the final version. Instead, Ukraine's parliament promised it would be included in a future vote. Soldiers are skeptical about such a promise. If it were approved, thousands of men would retire from the Ukrainian army. A potential solution would be to let soldiers rest for a few months instead of years. But even then, there aren't enough reserves to replace them. It's some kind of prison, says Alyeshka. You got into this army, you are doing your job, but what's next? What if the war lasts for 20 years? At least 44,000 Ukrainian men have left the country illegally since Russia invaded in 2022, according to border authorities in Moldova, Romania and Slovakia. But what happens then? Asks Alyeshka. The Russians will come to their home eventually. They will find everyone and enter every house. Someone has to hold the line. Alexander, a chief sergeant of the 36th Marine Brigade, tells me it's a miracle that the front line has held. The delays in Western aid led to Ukraine losing many more skilled and motivated soldiers than it should have. Our golden elite, those wonderful men who could have defeated the enemy, are now dead. While the weapons kept being delayed, We are paying with the blood of our soldiers. If Ukraine falls, Russia will become far stronger because they will have absorbed us. And who, then, will stand to fight as we do now? The West's best hope of peace is to give us everything we need now. Otherwise, in 5 or 7 years, the West will be fighting against me and my son.
That was Svitlana Munets. And finally, Michael Belov.
The modern Olympics, first held in Athens in 1896, in a genuflection to their Grecian predecessors, was the creation of Pierre de Coubertin, a French aristocrat. As this septet of books shows, from elusive angles, Coubertin's best-known quotation, "The most important thing in the Olympic Games is not winning but taking part," must rank as a paradigm example of a precept more honoured in the breach than the observance. It is rivalled only by his anticipation that the Games would be a vehicle for increasing friendly understanding among nations. In an elegant series of vignettes entitled Aux Armes, Sport and the French, an English Perspective, the sports writer David Owen notes that as early as 1900, the French authorities saw the Games as a competitive fulcrum in which to stress test new, potentially strategic technologies, shooting, motor vehicles and balloons. Lord Desborough, rightly rescued from the oubliette of history by Sandy Nairn and Peter Williams in Titan of the Thames, The Life of Lord Desborough, organised the first London Olympics in 1908. They were marred by various nations taking umbrage at perceived slights even in the opening ceremony. In Paris in 1924, there were outbreaks of nationalistic friction across a range of sports, including rugby, boxing, tennis, fencing and water polo, among both athletes and spectators, leading to a pessimistic headline in the Times, "Olympics doomed." By the time of the Berlin Games in 1936, no one could seriously credit the concept of a separation between politics and the Olympics. A false glow was cast over the reality of sport by the Oscar-winning film Chariots of Fire, loosely based on the Paris Olympics exactly a century ago. In Chariot's Return, Saving the Soul of the Games, Mark Ryan uses the careers of the two British sprinter gold medalists, Harold Abrahams and Eric Liddell, as a way to fast-forward the Olympic story, highlighting the abandonment of the Coubertin ideal of amateurism, of which Abrahams was a passionate aficionado, but simultaneously a prophet of its demise caused by the influx of money. The no-pay principle was only removed from the Olympic Charter in 1980. In Paris this summer, medal-winning track and field athletes will receive financial prizes too. The difference between the old-fashioned amateur sportsman and the modern professional is well illustrated by comparing Lord Desborough with Ewan Thomas, the Toff and the Tough. The former was a fencing silver medalist and all-round sportsman, excelling in eclectic pursuits. The latter was also a silver medalist and a single-minded track specialist who pushed himself into temporary depression, as he uncomfortably recounts in Brutal, my autobiography, "No more foxes, only hedgehogs." In Amsterdam in 1928, Paris's forgotten third man of British athletics, Douglas Lowe, won the 800 metres for the second time. Those games also saw women compete in athletics. The distress shown by some female competitors running the same distance as Lowe restricted their further participation to sprints until Tokyo 1964, though their cause are supported by Abrahams, whose wife later gave her name to an annual trophy for the best British woman athlete. Curiously, for an opponent of arbitrary discrimination, Abrahams led the fight against a British boycott of Hitler's Olympics, arguing that it would do more harm than good. In The Other Olympians, a true story of gender, fascism, and the making of modern sport, Michael Waters spurns the conventional analysis that those games dealt a fatal blow to Hitler's belief in Aryan supremacy because of the exploits of the black sprinter Jesse Owens, whom Abrahams later befriended. The author concentrates instead on the stories of two athletes, Zdeněk Kubek, a Czech sprinter, and Mark Weston, a British thrower, both assigned as female at birth, but later identified as biologically male. Neither competed in the games, but the winner of the women's 100 metres, the American Helen Stevens, was perceived as transgender. The dispute surrounding this disparate trio of athletes led to the introduction of the first Olympic sex tests, whose current version means that transgender persons will not compete in Paris this year, and intersex persons only under strict conditions. As for doping, the principal cause of the distortion of a level playing field in sport, Abrahams denied not only its utility but its existence. Ben Johnson, the Canadian sprinter who won the 100 metres in Seoul in 1988, but took the downward route from hero to zero in the space of 48 hours, was the subject of the most notorious Olympic scandal. Mary Ormsby's valiant case for his defence in World's Fastest Man, The Incredible Life of Ben Johnson, cannot bypass the fact that Johnson's steroid use was protracted and deliberate. In pursuit of the crucial aim of fair competition, international governing bodies prescribe protective policies for the elite athletes to deal not only with gender inequality and drugs, but differences of weight, age, and impairment. In regulating bodies, elite sport policies and their unintended consequences, Jaime Schultz contends that such measures, if benign in aim, can have adverse effects. Roger Bannister, the first sub-4-minute miler and medically trained neurologist, had a particular interest in such issues. Peter Whitfield's Roger Bannister, athlete and philosopher, recalls that only his relative failure in the 1500 metres in the 1952 Helsinki Olympics prompted him to extend his sporting career into 1954, his annus mirabilis. Bannister, while still a teenager, had declined an invitation to be part of Team GB in the 1948 London Olympics, but as a spectator, he speculated on whether the games were changing their nature. Was a new form of professionalism creeping in, with the athlete maintained by his country for the purposes of prestige? Might not the Olympics accentuate the political struggle between different nations? But he perceptively ended his soliloquy. At the beginning of each games, such questions are raised. Then they are forgotten, as the moving drama of success and failure unrolls itself. Nothing in this collection of unorthodox Olympic books casts doubt on the sportsman savant's conclusion. The medalists this year will vindicate the first three themes of the Olympic motto, plus vite, plus haut, plus fort, even if the fourth, ensemble, may remain aspirational. From Paris 1900, a five-month extravaganza where the core hallmark sports were complemented by peripheral outliers such as polo and pelota, to Paris 2024, where the equivalent outliers will be skateboarding and breakdance, in terms of the sporting agenda, one may say, chacun a son goût. In terms of the overall Olympic balance sheet, the apt apothegm would surely be, plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose.
And that's everything for this week. For more articles, pick up a copy of the Spectator magazine or check out our website. And if you've enjoyed this podcast, please do leave us a rating or a review. I'm Patrick Gibbons, and I hope you join us again next week.